Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And what's becoming a regular feature of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast is I ask for the capable assistance of Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin to field some of the questions that we get from our audience. Now, well, how do you get questions to us? Well, radioprogram@AOL.com is the email for questions. Make them brief and pithy. Don't send us 20 closely spaced pages of medical information because we won't be able to pore through it. But a consideration is questions of general interest for our listening audience. Radioprogram@AOL.com. By the way, that's how you order our newsletter, radioprogram@AOL.com. And it's a Monday. We're both back from a brief hiatus, a vacation. How was your Monday?
Very busy. Nicely busy.
It is busy. I mean, it's better than being bored. And so you've been kind of piecing through all your email and correspondence and trying to catch up, seeing patients with me. Mm-hmm. We were both in the office earlier today. And what do you have in store for the newsletter this week? I wrote an article that's sort of a continuation of my screed against George W. Bush's inappropriate stent. It didn't get that much press attention. I feel that a lot of people were remiss in their press reporting of it. It's kind of just blandly reported that, oh, yeah, that's routine. You know, you go to the cardiologist and you're fine, but, you know, there's a little blockage, and then they go in there and they just Roto-Rooter it, fix it all up. But actually, the New York Times, I was encouraged, had a very critical and incisive article about how many unnecessary stents are performed without specifically saying, because this would be a little too risque for the New York Times. They didn't call it the way I called it, but they did point out that a lot of stents are unnecessary, and the inescapable conclusion was that maybe George W. Bush's stent was maybe overreach, and that's something that is going to be in our newsletter. So you have you've been working on your newsletter contribution?
Actually, I have a couple of questions.
Okay.
That I will likely go into an answer to some degree.
Okay.
And we could talk about now. The first is Alan writes in, he would like to know if there's anything in alternative medicine to help raise testosterone levels when it's lower than normal.
Okay.
So there are lots of reasons for low testosterone. Diabetes is one. Type 2 diabetes may be one. Also, abdominal fat.
And that's a vicious mm-hmm. cycle because, you know, when you're kind of tired and bedraggled, you know, you have low T like in the commercials, you don't feel much like exercising. You don't feel much like having sex. So you let yourself go to pot a little bit because maybe your personal esteem is a little down. And that may lead to diabetes, and then diabetes in turn, and you're about to talk about what the effect of excess body fat is on testosterone.
What happens is that the fat cells release chemicals to aromatize the testosterone into estrogen, and that's a reason for low testosterone. There are other reasons for low testosterone, heavy drinking. And what do we define as heavy drinking? Oh, let's see. More than 2.5 drinks a day.
Wow.
For most people. Now, I wonder what the definition of heavy drinking in Europe might be.
Actually, I have an answer to that.
Uh-huh.
I just looked at a European study. It was very funny because they evaluated lifestyle factors, you know, smoking and exercise and drinking and the effect on longevity. And what they found was that all these things were bad for you except drinking. They actually couldn't find a level at which drinking was going to curtail your longevity. It was amazing. And they considered moderate drinkers. This is European. Men up to 4 drinks per day. That was moderate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Wow.
For women, I think for women it was like 2.5 drinks a day.
Uh-huh.
So little you know, women you know, some women can drink you under the table, but in general women have less of a capacity for absorbing the ill effects of alcohol. So, yeah, okay, so alcohol definitely can the way I know this is we would treat a lot of alcoholics during my medical training at Bellevue. And they would come in off the street, you know, and they were, you know, dead drunk or they were maybe uh-huh. experiencing DTs. And many of them had suspiciously good hair. They had great heads of hair.
Oh,
because
yeah.
They had very low levels of testosterone. So, you know, usual for, I mean, present company excluded, I seem to have a pretty good hairline. But that's hereditary. This suggestion was that they may have had low testosterone. And, you know, there are other bodily features. They actually develop gynecomastia, which is like breast tissue, you know, like sort of saggy breasts where, you know, it's kind of like a Seinfeld episode. You know, remember the man bro episode from Seinfeld? That George, and Seinfeld's father came up with a new intervention, and they wanted to call it the man bro.
Oh my gosh.
The bro.
I think I vaguely remember that.
Anyway, so that may be a sign of low testosterone. Anyway, so this guy wants to raise his testosterone, and you know, I got to say, you know, I listen to my own radio station, you know, a lot because I like talk radio, and there are so many commercials for things that are supposed to raise your testosterone. I mean, it is all over the dial. So what's the deal? Are there natural things that can help us raise our testosterone? What's your take on it?
I suppose things like tribulus, but let me first start with lifestyle factors.
Thank you.
Because first of all, if you're under chronic stress and you're not sleeping enough, that's going to cause low testosterone. Add on to that, you know, if you're drinking to the point of becoming a functional alcoholic, that also robs your sleep. That raises your cortisol level, which is a stress hormone. That also can knock down testosterone.
Right.
And testosterone is not only responsible for libido. Yes, of course it is, but it's also responsible for our vitality and our outlook on life, our optimism, all of that.
Motivation.
So it's just as important, exactly, motivation. Yep. It's just as important for women, even though we have 50 times less than men. Mm-hmm. However, it's just as important.
For women, it's like the Brill Cream commercial, a little dabble, do you? They don't need much. But a little, you know, will actually have a beneficial effect when we give natural bioidentical hormone replacement therapy. Just sometimes a little bit of testosterone, especially in women who've had a hysterectomy. Or, you know, even just after menopause. So, I agree. I mean, I think it's one of the best kept secrets is, you know, you don't need to buy expensive pills. Mm-hmm. Exercise is a great way to increase your testosterone, especially, strength training. A little less so, you know, with like these ultra marathoners. I think that may ultimately kill your sex drive. You know, very long distance cycling. Although I've never been a good enough cyclist to achieve this, you know, but these guys of the Tour de France, it's exhausting, it's debilitating, and testosterone levels might drop with excessive exercise, but that's not most people's problem. They're not exercising enough. And just feeling, you know, like vital, like kind of a sleek, energetic animal, you know, can kind of raise the animal spirits a little bit, raise the testosterone.
Absolutely. Strength training, as you started to say, is definitely important. And getting rid of that abdominal fat, the insulin resistance belly fat, that's extremely important. And once that starts to go down, risk of diabetes goes down. The diabetes could even be reversed, but then testosterone levels can return to normal because you're no longer turning it all into estrogen via the aromatase conversion.
So given a choice, and you know this is your forte, you know, talking diet, which of the following diets would be most appropriate for men desirous of increasing testosterone? A strict vegan diet, eliminating all forms of animal protein and fat, ultra low fat, emphasizing complex carbohydrates and starches, raw foods, versus a diet that is rich in protein, perhaps animal protein, as a source of healthy fats.
Protein and fat diet.
Right.
Absolutely.
It's a high hanging curveball that you can hit out of the park.
Yeah,
right?
All the branched chain of amino acids that are in animal protein, even things like whey protein as well, helps with muscle strength and so forth. A vegan diet is great if you want to become infertile. Do you remember that article?
Yeah, right.
Too much dependence on soy.
Well, yeah, actually, and this is a concern too. You know, sometimes moms will ask, you know, they're concerned about, shall I feed my child soy-based infant formula? Does it have a negative effect on young boys? Or perhaps, you know, older men who take tons and tons of soy, Could it have an impact on testosterone levels?
It could, because soy has a lot of phytoestrogens, and the phytoestrogens compete with our other hormones as well as testosterone. So there's the problem. And again, this is nature's argument for variety in the diet. You can't just overload on soy and glasses of soy milk and tofu all day long. We have to have variety more than anything, more than anything.
Absolutely.
Other supplements, by the way, we started to talk about tribulus maca.
Is
another favorite, that Peruvian
ginseng? I think it's very good for, let's think of it more, not so much as an aphrodisiac, although it does seem to help sex drive, and I find that it seems to be even more dramatic in women than in men, maybe because, women, they basically require less in the way of sex hormones, and something that's mild like maca can actually perk up the libido. Studies have actually shown that maca can sometimes raise testosterone. And I personally take it. I take it, not so much to be sexier, but I take it as something that increases energy and vitality and athletic performance.
Yeah.
So I think it's a good supplement for middle-aged men and women who want to keep that performance edge up, whether in the bedroom or on the on the track or in the pool.
Absolutely. Another mineral that occurs to me is zinc.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not sure if low zinc can cause low testosterone or the other way around. What do you think?
Well, I think that you have to have real serious zinc depletion to have low testosterone. Actually, the reputation that zinc has for raising testosterone, I think it's based on animal research where they deliberately deprived animals of zinc under experimental conditions, and they become infertile and they become less interested in sex, because zinc is actually important for synthesis of some of these sex hormones. But probably the vast majority of people are, especially those who are taking even just a regular multi, are getting adequate zinc to build testosterone. So taking super physiologic doses of zinc, first of all, could be harmful. It probably isn't going to raise your testosterone very much. Other things, that may have an impact on that. They talk a little bit about arginine as something that can be helpful for sexual potency. I don't think it can raise testosterone.
Yeah.
But some of the studies show that, arginine invokes that nitric oxide principle to dilate blood vessels, and that may be important for sexual functioning, particularly in men. But it isn't something that so much raises the testosterone. There's things like Epimedium, or it's got a really cool popular name. It's horny goat's weed. there's nothing brandier than a horny goat, I guess. I'm not sure. I think the research on that is, not that conclusive. And what troubles me? I gotta say. I'm upset at some of these things that purport to increase sexual potency because, first of all, there's a huge placebo effect. So, whatever you take, whether it's, Viagra, the popular prescription medication, Cialis, you name it, Levitra, or whether you take something that arrives in a plain brown unmarked package that you order off a website or via an 800 number, there's going to be a tremendous placebo effect. But conversely, let's say it doesn't work. And that's very, very disappointing. And I really think that to place your faith on some kind of magic panacea, like magic pill, it probably, if you're really concerned about potency, look at your relationship, look at, whether you're depressed. Make sure you get a proper medical workup to find out if you have a circulatory problem, because actually some studies show that there is a relationship between lack of sexual functioning or low libido or erectile dysfunction and cardiovascular disease. So, that may be a sign that you have, it could happen in a, superbly trained 20-year-old athlete. But it, it could also be a sign in an older individual that they're developing circulatory problems, prediabetes. And, I think you deserve a medical workup. And, hey, what's wrong with actually getting prescription testosterone? I mean, that's,
sure.
a lot of men say, I don't want to take that. I'm concerned. I have to go to the doctor. I have to pay. Or they're concerned about the hazards of that. But we prescribe it quite routinely and very safely.
And what about DHEA?
Absolutely.
For starters,
yes.
Yeah.
That's a great... And DHA sometimes modestly increases testosterone, but at the very least, it kind of fills fills that part of your hormone portfolio that does relate to muscle strength and mood and sexual performance. It's definitely milder than testosterone, but it's legal, it's available over the counter, and it's a less of a dramatic intervention, requires less monitoring than testosterone.
Yeah. Another good one, I think, for circulatory function is ginkgo biloba, although probably arginine is likely better than the ginkgo. But maybe in combination, I don't know. That could help.
And with the arginine,
circulation.
Yeah, with the arginine, the studies actually show you need quite a lot of arginine to get that erectile dysfunction benefit. Mm-hmm. It may be something like 5,000-6,000 milligrams a day, and that's quite a lot. It's hard, sometimes to take that much.
That is a lot, and we have to point out a caveat here because arginine is the amino acid that feeds the cold sore virus.
Yes, yes.
So some people who are prone to herpes outbreaks, cold sores, or anything like that, if they're taking arginine, it may feed the virus. So I think a good thing would be to balance it with at least as much lysine, if not more. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's appropriate. If you're going to take high-dose arginine, maybe a little lysine, because lysine confers some protection against recurrent herpes infections. All right, so that's the question of this gentleman. You got anything else for us in the mailbox?
Patricia writes in, and she's a huge fan of yours, Dr. Hoffman. She just picked up your book, 7 Weeks to a Settled Stomach, and she says...
Oh, my goodness, it must be like a tattered copy, because I wrote that like so long ago. But, I'm actually thinking of reissuing it. I'm actually thinking of updating it and reissuing it as an e-book. I've been talking about that to some people. And
that's
a great
idea.
It'd be like, 2013, because the last time I wrote it, it must have been like 1993. So
wow.
7 Weeks to a Settled Stomach, 20 years later.
Yeah.
Reboot.
There you go. Excellent, excellent. Get on it. Yeah. So she bought the book, 7 Weeks to a Settled Stomach, and she says, I'm going to begin reading it for treating my collagenous colitis.
Mm-hmm.
And she actually wanted to know what you think of food combining with this particular disease and so forth, and anything else that you and I would have to say about it.
Well, Rio, first let's talk about collagenous colitis. There's ulcerative colitis, and there's Crohn's disease, and then there's a very uncommon condition called collagenous colitis. And I got to say, I see about 50 patients with Crohn's and ulcerative colitis for every one patient with collagenous colitis. And I didn't know if our procedures for treating ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease would work for collagenous colitis, because it's different. I mean, it sounds the same, but it's a different kind of condition. But actually, I've seen it work for the couple of patients who come with collagenous colitis, the approach that we use. But why don't you first talk a little bit about food combining, what it can and can't do, what the theory is behind that?
The food combining, was first of all written a long time ago. I forget the name of the book, but the food combining was written by somebody who had a lot of stomach and bowel issues and was finally finding
Wasn't that the Beverly Hills Diet?
Was it?
Yeah,
What's the one where you start the day with fruit and you eat nothing but fruit?
I think that was the Beverly Hills Diet. That was an enormous bestseller, but that was a really long time ago. But yeah, it was the idea that you would eat one type of food at each meal. Sort of
right.
Like,
don't combine your protein with your carbohydrate.
Right.
Or something like that.
Yeah, but man, that really took off. That was a huge success.
It did. But for most of our colitis patients, even our collagenous colitis patients, the few that we've had, we found some good success with the specific carbohydrate diet, the Gottschall diet.
Right. Yeah, before we get onto that, it was just a comment on the food combining. The premise behind food combining, and it sounds really persuasive, is that animals in the wild, when they come upon food, they don't sit there and arrange things on the plate. Like mom used to tell you, you need, your protein, your carb, your vegetable, and, whatever, it's like a pie chart of different components that you have a balanced meal. The premise behind the food combining was that when animals eat, they find one food, and then in their infinite wisdom, they don't eat a lot of other things to muck up their digestion. So the idea would be to have fruit for breakfast, and maybe have protein for lunch, and then have carbohydrates for dinner. And I think that was the basic idea. You know, they managed to get 300 pages out of that. But, because fruit's very easy to digest, goes through you fast.
On their own, right.
Right.
But if eaten after a protein may ferment and so forth, and this could cause problems.
Right. The mixture was right. But, I have to say that for the vast majority of relatively healthy people, this is not that important. I think also, if you actually look at the way that primitive man ate, say an a caveman, so-called Paleolithic man, would slaughter an animal, they would eat, the animal protein, but they would also include some veggies, and actually some of it, it doesn't sound very appetizing, but some of the vegetables they would get would come from the stomach contents of the animal, so that they would get a more balanced mix of nutrients.
Yeah.
And so, it's not even historically accurate that that's the way that people ate. So, my take on that is that unless you have the most delicate digestion, this works for some people. Some people say, it really calms down my digestion. But I think that's generally for people who have very weak digestion, maybe inappropriate enzyme production.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a solution. They have less bloating. They feel less satiety and doesn't mess with their challenge their weak
mm-hmm.
digestive systems. So anyway, so that pretty much food combining, we don't recommend that often, do we?
No, not often. Maybe for some people with like gastroparesis or very slowed down intestinal transit time, those quickly absorbable carbohydrates like fruits can be helpful for them. So there are certain instances. It's just the importance of no one diet fits everybody, so we have to investigate first what's happening, what are the problems, what are the symptoms, what can we do about it? So
anyway, onto the collagenous colitis, then. So our approach would be what?
The specific carbohydrate diet, which actually is coming back to the question of fermentation. It's to reduce fermentation. All the grains are removed. Fruits are allowed. However, because the grains are the most highly fermentable food group, these are removed, as well as other starches like potatoes, and soybeans and things of that nature. And so what happens is the belly quiets down, there's less fermentation, colitis over a period of time can go into remission or go into check, but the collagenous colitis, that can occur after, a round of antibiotics or for some other reason?
No, that may be pseudomembranous colitis, which is the aftermath of something like a C. difficile infection. This is it's a different and mysterious disease where the intestines seem to harden, as it were, with collagen deposition, and it's not so much inflammatory like ulcerative colitis. However, patients do achieve relief with a specific carbohydrate diet.
Yeah.
But it's a little different, type of condition. But we've had patients, I can remember several who've done well with the SCD. Where's the information on that?
The SCD, breakingthevicious cycle.info is their actual website, breakingthevicious cycle.info. And Elaine Gottschall's book, God Rest Your Soul, is Breaking the Vicious Cycle.
Right.
And it goes into great detail about this eating plan and how it's helpful. And it really goes a little bit into the, not just the rationale, but the biochemistry on the gut level of what it's doing to offer relief, which is very interesting and very motivating. It can be very motivating if you're very interested in how the gut works. So
right.
I highly recommend it.
There's several levels, I think, for people to get into this. One is to go to the websites, SCD Info website, get the book, try the diet. But I really think there's a good argument for intervention by an expert nutritionist like you, Leila. And how many colitis patients do you think you've dealt with by now?
Oh, my goodness.
If it's not hundreds, it's scores, I think.
No, It's so many, honestly. Yeah. I have to really think about
that. And they're different. Uh-huh. And what we find is, I mean, actually, what happens at the Hoffman Center is we rarely see people who are, you know, can just pick up a book. I mean, a lot cheaper. You pick up a book for whatever, $12, and follow the directions in the book, or go to a website and do it yourself, and you're cured. Great. I mean, when that happens, we don't even hear from the people. And there are many people who are successful doing that. The people we see are the people who are stuck. For one reason or another, the diet is helping a little bit or not at all, and we have to tweak it. And so what we will do is we will do some trial and error with eliminations. We'll sometimes tell people don't eat everything in the book. You know, start with the initial diet that's very soft and easily digestible. Or perhaps we'll discover that something that's allowed on the diet the patient's actually intolerant to. You know, almonds are a big thing on that diet.
Yes.
Or dairy, you know, fermented dairy is permitted, but some patients don't do well with that. So, you know, we have to do a little detective work and customize.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's collagen.
That was from Pat. Yep.
Let's see, can we get an easy question here? I've got a few. Because collagen is collagen. That's a little weird.
Yeah.
All right. This one's a little unusual question. There are no easy questions this week. This one's from Carolyn. Dr. Hoffman, what is your opinion of pulsed electromagnetic field therapy for the treatment of osteoporosis? Pulse electromagnetic field therapy. First of all, a pulsed electromagnetic therapy is actually a type of therapy that has been studied in relationship to healing bone fractures. And it's very interesting because what they do is they put a coil around the injury, around the broken bone, you know, outside the body, obviously. And then they run an electromagnetic current through there, creating a magnetic field that aligns the healing bone cells so that the bone heals. And it's got a lot of promise, but I don't even think it's used all that much these days. So to extend that to the treatment of osteoporosis, I think that's very experimental. It's not readily available. It's a little way out. And
is it like that vibration machine?
Nah, that's okay. Different. But that's interesting. Yes, there is a type of therapy, and I've talked about it on Health Talk, and we're going to try and get the manufacturers of this new device on the radio. I think they're a little reluctant to come on the radio because they're still wrangling with the FDA for full approval of this. I think they've got the device approved, but they can't say that it's actually going to help a disease. You know, it's sort of like they just say, well, it's a healthful thing, yada, yada, yada. Supports bone health, but they can't say that it is actually a treatment for osteoporosis because then you have to do, you know, very, very expensive and extensive testing with the Food and Drug Administration to win approval. But nonetheless, there are several devices on the market, and the one that interests me is made by a company called Marodyne, 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 and you can check them out on the internet. And that's based on research done at Stony Brook over many decades, where they actually started with sheep who had osteoporosis. You know, sheep get osteoporosis. You know how you can turn a sheep into an osteoporotic sheep?
How?
You give them a hysterectomy, and you take out their ovaries.
Oh yeah, okay.
And then so sheep become osteoporotic, just like, you know, middle-aged women.
Mm-hmm.
And so these poor sheep, then they put them on these vibrating platforms. And lo and behold, it actually seems to strengthen their bone. And they've studied their, you know, structure of their bones. They've looked at the individual bone cells under the microscope, and it seems to send a signal to remineralize and strengthen the bone. So I really like the research there. They've spent millions of dollars on research. Stony Brook is the place where they've done the research. You can look it up. The company's Marodyne. They offer now they have a consumer model, but the price point is a little challenging. I think it's like $19.99, and that decimal point, not in the middle, it's at the end. It's like $1,999, I think, for their device.
Wow.
If I'm not mistaken. It might be $9.99, but that's still pretty pricey for the average person.
Uh-huh.
What I suggest, I mean, if a group of osteoporotic women could get together like a, you know, Canasta or Bridge Club or something like that, and like, you know, get together, you know, a couple times a week and maybe stand on the platform. They could go in together and
<That's> you
know, less expensive that way. You know, ante up, you know, $500 a piece, uh-huh. and then, you know, they uh-huh. could afford it. But, so it, I mean, I think there is potential for this. But while we're on the subject, I mean, you're very good at working with, we have a lot of patients who have osteoporosis, and, you know, what are some of the things we use for that?
Oh, well,
supplement-wise.
We love Ostera, which is hops, which, okay, don't everybody start drinking beer, but it's shown that hops can help reduce the rate of bone turnover. Bone is supposed to turn over. It's living tissue, but we don't want that to happen too rapidly. And I suppose it works a little bit like the way the bisphosphonates do in slowing down that bone turnover, but not nearly like that or with any side effect. Another supplement is strontium.
Mm-hmm.
Strontium is another one that's it's a trace element. Certainly magnesium. People aren't getting enough magnesium in the diet. We also need vitamin K. And vitamin K helps direct calcium back to the bones where they belong and not in our coronary arteries where they may be winding up, given all this calcium we've been taking since the early 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly calcium is important, but not as important as we previously thought. Maybe not more than, 400 to 600 milligrams total a day in a supplement. Generally, we don't recommend anymore for anyone to take 1,200 milligrams of calcium.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think the days of very aggressive calcium supplementation are behind us. Although we do use a product called OsteoSupport, which, you know, I have to say, I may have had some foresight because I designed the product, a long time ago, like 12, 15 years ago. And people looked at it and said, well, there's not enough calcium in there. I said, look, that's not the most important part. I combined the calcium with magnesium and some Ipraflavone, which is not a soy. It's a type of bone-enhancing product. And also cofactors like silica and boron. And it's a nice, you know, general osteoporosis support product.
Mm-hmm.
OsteoSupport's available at drhoffman.com. So, those are some of the components.
Another important one is DHEA.
Yes,
I believe for many of our case study patients where we've been able to reverse bone loss,
mm-hmm,
and trend towards bone remineralization, also included some DHEA, especially in the women who are low.
Mm-hmm.
It's best to check levels and maybe include some DHEA.
Mm-hmm.
So that's absolutely another way. And that's essentially the arsenal.
Yeah. Yeah,
well,
that's pretty much some new information on essential fatty acids too. The omega-3 fatty acids even seem to help bone as well. And actually, a new thing that we've just introduced into our dispenser, we're just beginning to use it because it's brand new. It's a product called Ostinol, Ostinol. You've seen probably that we've added it recently to our dispensary.
Yes.
And that product has got its dual purpose. It's osteoarthritis and osteoporosis. And what it is, it's something called bone morphogenic protein, which means that it actually helps the bone to build new bone. It helps to support the development of new fresh bone tissue. It was actually originally pioneered in the treatment of injuries and fractures. Now is being used to heal osteoarthritis, where there's some good studies on this, and also some of the new studies are looking at Ostinol in osteoporosis. And, you know, I actually talked to some of my colleagues who have been using this stuff for longer than I have, and they say they get very good results with Ostinol.
Mm-hmm.
And these are even in patients who don't take strontium. I tend to think of strontium as one of the stronger agents we're using,
mm-hmm,
but for one reason or another, some people, they don't want to take it, or they've been there, done that. It's not adequate. Ostinol may be a good backup for that. It also goes by the name Cyplexanol, but our product is Ostinol. Is that on our website? I'm not even sure.
I'm not seeing that on our website.
Okay.
As we speak, so that's something we need to
post.
Very important one we forgot is vitamin D.
Oh, of course. Yeah. No, I.
But we're always talking about vitamin D.
But yeah, and really, so. Yeah. This, I mean, it's important to say this is that I wish I had a buck for every woman who comes to see me with bad osteoporosis, who's on a very heavy-duty medication, Fosamax or Actonel or Beneva, you know, the Flying Nun, Sally Field drug. And when I check their vitamin D, it's way under 40. So it's actually futile to try and build bone with a medication if your vitamin D is under 40. It mm-hmm. won't work. And that's why oftentimes these people said, you know, I've been on these medications and they really, you know, I think my score has gone up a point, but I've taken these medications for years and it hasn't helped. And it's like, oh my goodness, you've missed an opportunity because those medications might have worked if your vitamin D was adequate. They just needed help from the vitamin D. So even if you're going to take a conventional medicine, just make sure you get your vitamin D checked. Make sure it's over 40, please.
But unfortunately, in conventional medicine, many doctors will still say 20 is adequate.
Yes, yes.
So that's a problem.
Yeah, because that's what the lab range is. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at the, you know, it'll say okay because your level is 23 or 28. And that's true. You know, you may not get rickets. You may not suffer from, you know, overt vitamin D deficiency disease. But it's just simply not enough to build bone.
Yeah.
So, okay. So, you know, I think we pretty much handled that question. And do we have time for one more?
Absolutely.
Okay. So, this is not really that much of a nutritional question, but I think there's a nutritional dimension to it. It's from Larry, who writes, Dr. Hoffman, can you tell me what your opinion of doxazosin is? I am taking it for enlarged prostate and mild hypertension. It seems to interfere with my exercise. I am a long-distance cyclist, and I read that this medicine is dangerous for exercise in the heat, causing potential problems with dizziness, etc. I'm 67 years old. Thank you very much, Larry. God bless.
Wow.
Larry, he's 67, and he's a long-distance cyclist. I just rode 30 miles yesterday, by the way, but I'm not 67. I hope to be able to ride 30 miles when I'm 67. But
I'm sure you will.
Well, thank you for your confidence.
Yeah.
But Larry is a long-distance cyclist, and he's got a large prostate. So, okay, so this is actually a medication that is called Hytrin, H-Y-T-R-I-N. And Hytrin is an alpha blocker. You've heard of beta blockers as an alpha blocker. And what that does is it doesn't really shrink the prostate. It changes the signals down there so that you need to urinate less frequently. So it helps you sleep through the night. And, oh, by the way, it kind of kills two birds with one stone because it lowers blood pressure and you have mild hypertension. That should do the trick. Now, what concerns me, and one of the reasons why I'm just trying like hell not to be on any kind of medication, is because I'm very active and I am concerned about the effects of so many medications on physical exercise. So, for example, we know about the statins, that the statins actually have been shown in animal experiments that animals run less quickly on a treadmill when given a statin. In mouse models or rat models, it slows them down. Now, this is without them having overt muscle pain or abnormalities on blood tests. Similarly, there's some medications that impair your ability to sweat, and that's what this medication does. So I don't know, you know, you're pretty attuned to medication side effects. I mean, there are some medications where I wouldn't recommend that people get into a very hot sauna or a hot tub as a result of the fact that they may be heat intolerant when they're taking these medications. I think medications like beta blockers, heart drugs, these many high blood pressure medications, and psychiatric medications will do this too. So that, you know, it's going to curtail exercise. I think that's really a pity with the statins, because precisely what you need if you've got a heart problem is you need to sustain good levels of exercise, have good energy.
Right.
But if it slows you down, that's counterproductive.
Yeah. I wonder, however, if they added CoQ10 to that statin regimen, if that could help to turn that around.
It could take care of it a little bit, but I've actually seen patients who take CoQ10 and they still have muscle aches from the statins. It's that bad. So, you know, it's just one of those things where it's hard to get around it.
Yeah.
So, you know, so for this poor guy, let's talk about, in terms of medication options, it might be preferable to take something like Avodart or Proscar. Those actually shrink the prostate and might relieve the problem of frequent urination. They won't do anything for the blood pressure, but at least they will permit you to exercise. And I don't think they're, you know, not all medications interfere with exercise. And that might do the trick for the enlarged prostate. What about the natural stuff for enlarged prostate?
Saw palmetto. Mm-hmm. Pygium is another good one.
You know, I just went to botanical gardens here in New York. They have an exhibit. You better catch it soon because it's going to close on September 9th. But they have an exhibit on natural products, natural botanicals that have medical applications. So everything from, I think they even have some opium plants and some marijuana plants.
Oh, my.
Medical, you know, medicinal herbs. And, you know, so one of the things was saw palmetto, and they actually talk about its benefits in terms of shrinking the prostate. So, yeah.
And because it's about inflammation, I imagine that other helpful supplements would be curcumin and boswellian, certainly fish oil.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a good regimen.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I would say, I mean, as a cyclist, I got to say that sometimes spend a lot of time on that hard saddle can irritate the prostate. And if there's concerns about prostatic enlargement or frequent urination, then, you know, check out some of the new saddles that actually are sort of have a cutout design that enable you to stay longer in the saddle without developing urinary problems. It's actually not that uncommon for cyclists to develop urinary problems or even erectile dysfunction because of those very hard saddles and the vibration and spending a lot of time putting pressure on the prostate. So, you know, that's a possibility for Larry. All right. By the way, the summer is rapidly waning.
Yeah.
And what that means is that we're looking forward to a new series of your lectures. Now, they should be starting up again in the month of September. So, is there a way that people can get information about that? Have we set a date so far?
No, we have not set a date yet. We have yet to do that.
Okay.
But the first one will be at sometime in September, probably towards the end of September, if not even early October. Mm-hmm. They should go to the website, drhoffman.com. Okay. And certainly those of you who are subscribing to the newsletter, there will be information about that there as well.
We'll give you the heads up. So we haven't yet decided on that. But, hey,
mm-hmm.
Summer is waning. What did you do over your vacation? I mean, come on. You went and you probably had a little pizza, or you maybe had, you know, went and had an ice cream or something like that.
Or ice cream? Nah.
No?
That
doesn't float your boat, huh?
No, that doesn't really float my boat. You know, I probably ate I ate a lot of lobster.
All right. Yeah,
I had lobster.
Great.
I had tuna. I had a little bit of swordfish. Ding, ding, ding. Mercury.
Yeah, mercury. But you figured, you know, you do it so rarely that's
it's true. It's right. True. And, you know, we love shellfish, other shellfish, clams,
right.
And oysters and
right.
So forth. And all of that, and that's basically it. Otherwise, I'm a certified beach bum, pretty much.
Right. So you kind of enhanced your vitamin D quotient a little bit there?
I would believe so. Looking at my skin color, I would hope
good.
So.
So, all right. So rested and refreshed, we're back. And we'll make this a regular thing. You know, you have a fan club out there. I mean, I was a little miffed. You know, people aren't saying like, man, you know, Dr. Robin, you sound so great. People said, Layla, she's amazing. You got to bring her back for some more of these podcasts. And,
thank you, fans.
Yeah, I mean, you got a whole fan club out there.
Oh.
So okay, so the way you know, for those of you, if you're listening to this, you probably know already how to get the podcast. But iTunes, you can download the podcast from iTunes or at drhoffman.com. Spread the word. And I've got this new thing. You're not going to like this, Layla. You're not going to like this, but. You know, you give me like a little time off, and I get in all kinds of trouble. You're not going to like this latest thing, my latest announcement. I have started to tweet.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Here we go. All right. We got to add that to the newsletter now.
I know. I'm issuing tweets about things that get me kind of impassioned. Forgive me. I issued too many tweets after last night's baseball game in Boston where A-Rod got beaned by Ryan Dempster. So I'll try not to barrage you with too much in a way of sports tweets and, you know, keep it factual. Talk about complementary medicine, vitamin supplements, diet, and issues related to health. But at Dr. Ronald Hoffman is my Twitter handle. At Dr. Ronald Hoffman is where you can follow me on Twitter. So look for some of my urgent dispatches as I find articles or take pictures or share information with you.
Terrific.
We're just getting information out every which way. So we just entered a whole new dimension. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Layla.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we'll talk to you again next week. Let's gather some questions. Radioprogram@AOL.com is the place to send your questions, and we'll try and tackle them on our Intelligent Medicine podcast. Until next time, I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman.